Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Tomorrow, families and friends across the country will gather around tables filled with food to share and give thanks. On today's Your Call, in addition to giving thanks, we want to recognize the true history of Thanksgiving. For many Native Americans, Thanksgiving is a national day of mourning, the annual tradition to acknowledge Native genocide, honor ancestors, and protest struggles Native Americans continue to face. The United American Indians of New England have organized a national day of mourning. They say it's a day of remembrance and spiritual connection, as well as a protest of the racism and oppression Native Americans continue to experience. To talk about what we can learn from Native Americans about giving thanks and the true history of Thanksgiving, we are joined by two guests. Hartman Dietz is a member of the Wampanoag tribe, and he joins us from Mashpee, Massachusetts. Hi, Hartman. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, how you doing?
Hi, good. Thank you. We're also joined in studio by Rulon Tongan, Artistic Director and Choreographer of Dancing Earth, an intertribal indigenous contemporary dance group. Dancing Earth will be performing 500 Years of Resistance, a performance honoring Native land treaties and water rights on Friday, December 1st at 7 p.m. at the Brava Theater in San Francisco. They will also be performing on December 2nd and 3rd, and you can find information at yourcallradio.org. And Rulon joins us in studio. Hi, Rulon. Welcome to the show.
Hi there, and it's so great to hear of Hartman. Hartman, I used to go to the Mashpee Powwow back in the day, experienced the fireball games, and I've been keeping up with the tremendous work that the Wampanoag people have been doing in terms of language restoration, so it's an honor to be on the show with you.
Yeah, thanks. Honor to be on the show with you. It's the language project is a great thing to come out of the forced religious conversion. We had the Bible printed in Wampanoag, the first book in North America printed in North America. So it's amazing how sometimes these things that have caused us such pain and struggle in past end up being the seeds for our regeneration and renewal in current times.
You know, I just found an incredible article about this in the Associated Press, and I want to ask you about this, Hartman, but I wanted to welcome our third guest to the show. Kenny Ramos is a performing artist with Dancing Earth. Hi, Kenny. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Halka. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you. You're a California native.
Yes, I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You want to give us a bit about your background?
For sure. I could, I'd like to introduce myself formally. Hauka memiu temenue, inyaj Kenny Ramos, we ichahi, inyan yue, we ichahi, benegas, nyapum welch, Barona Reservation Kupai. Hello, everyone. How are you? In my language, hello is a big greeting. That also means may the fire in your spirit continue to burn. So I'm wishing all that to everyone out there. My name's Kenny Ramos. I'm Degenyo Ipai Kumiai from the Brona Band of Mission Indians, and I grew up on the Brona Indian Reservation, which is in San Diego County, and my families there are Benegas and Welch, and that's what I basically said in my language introduction.
It's beautiful. Thank you. Well, why don't we start off by talking about this language project, Hartman, because it is getting some attention in the national media. Give us a little bit of background about this. I'll just read the lead from the AP. The Massachusetts tribe whose ancestors shared a Thanksgiving meal with the Pilgrims nearly 400 years ago is reclaiming its lost language, one school child at a time. Hartman, what do you think about that lead?
It's a accurate lead. It's pretty good. To me, it's wonderful news. I was involved with the language project for about 10 years. 10 years as a student and about 4 years as an instructor. It was at the time when I was involved with the program, the programming was largely geared towards adult learners, which, you know, I benefited from tremendously. But the fact of the matter is that if you want a language to live and thrive and grow and become a part of the community and the culture without people who have to attend classes, it really means instilling that language in the next generation, the youth. So if these kids grow up speaking it and it becomes a part of how they communicate from a very young age, that's the best way to ensure that this language will survive into the future. So I'm really happy that we have these immersion schools for the kids, and it's so important to continuing this language. And really, language is embedded with systems of thought and worldview, because you have to structure the way that you talk about ideas, the way that you relate ideas, in the framework of a language which structures how these thoughts are presented. So, you know, we have to speak of everything as animate or inanimate, and, you know, like the Spanish speaks of masculine and feminine. So in this very foundational thinking of the world, we have to think about what has life, what has spirit, what has, you know, what is another living being that we're looking at. So there's this acknowledgement in the fundamental part of the language that's not like English and not like anything else, you know, that I know of in the world, other than Algonquian languages.
According to this piece, Jennifer Weston, director of the tribe's language department, says that the tribe is in need of more adults who are fluent in this language to continue expanding it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You need instructors. You need people to look after the kids when they're at the school. You know, you need people to be, you know, to take the lead. So that's certainly a part of what makes teaching the young kids possible, is having a core of adults that are able to engage with the kids in that way.
Hartman, you're joining us from Mashpee, Massachusetts. Tell us a little bit about your tribe, the Wampanoag tribe.
Mashpee is one community of Wampanoag people, of five that exist now. When the Pilgrims arrived, there was 70 communities of Wampanoag people. A series of 9 wars over 100 years, and exposure to disease, and slavery, and forced relocation has withered that number from 70 communities down to only 5. When the English showed up on our shores, we greeted them, we fed them because we saw they were sick and they were starving. And there was 50 of them who landed, and now there's 250,000 Mayflower descendants or something like that. And at the time, there was, you know, maybe about 250,000 Wampanoag people, and now we're down to maybe about 5,000 in all. So it certainly is a telling right there, just in the numbers of you know, what happened and what occurred. We've been here in our traditional homeland for the duration. I'm sitting on 2 acres of land right now that's never been owned by a white man ever, in spite of being one of the earliest points of contact. And that's something I know Native people throughout the Americas, it's not something that everybody can say. Most folks have been moved this way or that, so we're very fortunate in that. But also in that, we've experienced the whole range of colonial oppressive behaviors, and still continue to experience them today.
Do you feel, Hartman, that because of social media, that more of this information is getting out? I've just noticed over the years that a lot of national outlets like Fusion, Al Jazeera Plus, for example, ask Native Americans around this time of year what tomorrow's holiday actually means to them. And these videos are getting shared hundreds of thousands of times.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like social media is a huge means of getting this information out there. And one of the things that you really see is that some of these smaller, non-conventional media outlets are the ones that are bringing these stories out and getting a lot of attention for them, where you see some of the more traditional media still shies away from these things as if they're, you know, afraid of upsetting somebody, or as if there is not a matter of relevance of Native people, even on Thanksgiving. You know, we're irrelevant even on this day where we're built into the mythology of the telling of the holiday. Even at this point in time, the major media outlets, the corporate-controlled outlets, tend to shy away from us. And I think it's because the fact of the matter is that many of these outlets understand that they're built on our sacrifice. They're built on what they've taken from us, and to acknowledge us fully in the modern day, it means to have to acknowledge how we've gotten to where we are now. So they shy away from talking about it.
It's a really good point. The smaller outlets are trying to do a good job, but then you have, I was so blown away by this, the New York Times food section last week had a huge spread, Thanksgiving, with a big turkey under it, and they asked 9 writers to reflect on Thanksgiving. 9. They didn't ask one indigenous person to contribute. And the only one who mentioned the word genocide was a Vietnamese immigrant, which I thought was interesting. And I wrote the New York Times food editor to ask him why he didn't include any Indigenous writers, and I haven't heard back yet.
And we have so many incredible Native chefs right now that are very newsworthy. Mm. They're like being talked about in the regular restaurant world because what's happening in the food world is about sort of local ingredients, which is basically indigenizing the food sourcing.
But why do you think that is? Where on one hand, information's getting out and people are being asked to contribute. On the other hand, not at all. What do you think about that, Kenny?
Oh, about people...
just sharing their stories. I mean, it's 2017. We're having a really important conversation about race in this country, about history in this country.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's... I don't know. It's hard to say because the society is so built on the making us invisible, and that really just permeates through all aspects of it. And now in the times we're living in, I think people are starting to want to learn more and want to wake up. And social media has become this totally new avenue where we can get stories and information out there. But then also thinking about who consumes what types of media, like who was reading that Times article, mm-hmm. right? Was that a print that you saw that on?
Yes.
Yeah. So like who reads that and who's on social media? I think it's a lot of, I think that's a big actually thing to look at is who's consuming these things and what are these things catered for? So it seems maybe social media is a outlet to share these newer, these perspectives have always been here, but now they're just starting to get more attention. So maybe that's the medium that we're seeing younger consumers get their information and the older generation still stuck in print. Not that that's bad, but maybe that also is affecting the type of information that is being produced in that medium.
And I think Kenny and I take seriously, you know, we travel, like, you know, all of the Native artists of Dancing Earth travel quite a bit. We're freelancers, so we're, you know, this year I was in Guam, Australia, Canada, and many states across the U.S. As I mentioned to Hartman, you know, I remember going to Mashpee Powwow. So I'm around a lot of places, and we take our responsibilities. Like, I just wanted to be a dancer. I didn't realize I had to be a, you know, spokesperson, advocate, activist, which is now inherent in the content of my work and how I share it. And, you know, in my role related to dance of choreography, performing, directing, teaching, lecturing, this kind of, I consider this less of public relate like PR, but more about community engagement. And, you know, I didn't even want to be a producer, but we have to sort of get to controlling what, like not just be someone that's, taking part in something that's already been created, but how do we start to be the ones that are generating these? Mm-hmm. And you know, like there's this wonderful Native Flicks. It's an answer to Netflix. It's Native owned. It's Native content. So if anyone, and this happens a lot, people say, oh, are there any sources for some Native films? Mm-hmm. I'm like, yes, go to Native Flicks and you can see documentaries, feature films, all generated by Native people. And so that, I think, is really important. And, you know, I think whether or not that's what we intended to go into the arts for, that's what we end up becoming, is these ambassadors for larger, like we become the vehicle through which these stories are understood. And mm-hmm. Kenny understands that as an actor, mm-hmm. the different ways that that can happen.
Yeah, and well, and it's really interesting, I think, as an Indigenous artist working within those structures and realizing that there's so much work, more work that's needed from us. Sometimes it's not fair because you just want to act or you just want to dance, but then you realize, oh my gosh, but it's now I feel my responsibility to try and infiltrate these power structures in order to actually affect change that will actually be beneficial to the people that are going to be coming after me, which is hopefully more Native actors, more Native mm-hmm. dancers. And it's funny because that ties into like seven generations and thinking about not just the next seven generations of our genealogical line, but also just the next seven generations of our people, even as people who are going to be following this artist path, and how can we make that easier for them and what that's going to do when we are able to be seen on stage and to be seen in dance and to be seen on TV regularly. And that hopefully would start to answer this invisible issue.
Kenny, how do you feel this time of year as families across the country will sit down for dinner tomorrow to give thanks?
With Thanksgiving? Yeah, you know, because I mean, we grew up gathering, mm-hmm. you know, and I grew up on my reservation, and we gather to eat, and even for this weekend, and, you know, but it's, you know, we're aware of the atrocities of this country as we've suffered our own growing up in what is essentially what's created to be a concentration camp for us. So, you know, it's a, but you know, we're always thankful. I've always been taught to be thankful. We're thankful to be alive. I'm thankful to survive. I'm thankful for everyone that came before me and that passed down what they passed down for me to know who I am as a Kumeyaay person and to be alive in contemporary day. So, I mean, we are very thankful, but, you know, I think we're always constantly living in this. They say living in two worlds, right? People talk about that, and I don't know. I live in one world. I live on the earth. But, you know, but there are these, you know, these dualities of understandings, I think, that are inherent with our experiences as Indigenous people, just understanding there's so much more that meets the eye, and there's so much more than what they're telling you, than what you're learning in your school book, than what the media is saying, than what this holiday's about. There's so much more.
Right.
And so it's just a duality.
Well, and speaking of what you learn in your high school book or your grade school book, I love the book Lies My Teacher Told Me by James Lowen. And he's got a lot of information about Thanksgiving. He examined how 12 textbooks used in high school American history classes teach Thanksgiving. And Hartman, I'd love for you to talk about this. And I know that there is an ongoing struggle and movement to encourage changes in curriculum. And he writes that in the history book, The American Tradition, this is a high school book that's widely used across the country. It says, after some exploring, the Pilgrims chose the land around Plymouth Harbor for their settlement. Unfortunately, they arrived in December and were not prepared for the New England weather. However, they were aided by friendly Indians who gave them food and showed them how to grow corn. When warm weather came, the colonists planted, fished, hunted, and prepared themselves for the next winter. After harvesting their first crop, they and their Indian friends celebrated their first Thanksgiving. So this is what high school students across the country are learning and reading.
Yeah, and you know, it's interesting. I mean, I've lived in the world of the arts as well, but I'm primarily an educator, and it, you know, like you're talking about the things that you need to do as an artist or as an educator or as almost anything when you engage with the wider world as a Native person. You have to become an advocate. You have to become an activist. You have to become these things because there's such an idea that's so embedded from the American history books, from, you know, the telling of the story, that we're extinct, that we're wiped out, that there aren't any Indians left. And, you know, I meet people oftentimes and they'll say, oh, you're a real Native American, a real Indian. And I say, yeah, well, I thought you all were dead. This is the first one I've ever met. And you know that that's probably not the truth. They probably just never bothered to find out more about the people that are around them. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that these ideas are so deeply embedded and people talk about, you know, the ideas of what happened and how terrible it was. And it was so long ago that they ignore things like, you know, the fact of the matter is that we're gearing up for one of the next great land grabs of Indian land right now today, as Trump administration is looking to take land out of trust for Native people across the Americas to get mm-hmm. access to mineral wealth that's under their feet. And when we dismiss these histories, the accurate histories that are not these fabricated myths of how everybody planted and got along fine and manages to overlook the 100 years of war and the slavery and the decapitated Indian heads that are dumped on people and the throwing of babies into rivers so that their mothers will chase after them to drown, you know, these horrors are part of the histories that they wrote about and in their own hand, and yet are completely ignored and wiped clean from the slate to say that their friends got together to have dinner. You know, when you actually read the firsthand accounts of history, when you read, you know, Mort's relations, when you read William Bradford's of Plymouth Plantation, when you read, you know, Eliot, you understand that there was not a friendship there. There was a lot of distrust. There was a lot of discomfort. Because the people who came here from across the ocean, they were not seeking religious freedom as we think of it today. They were seeking religious exclusion. They wanted to be the only religion in town, and they wanted to be able to force others to believe as they believed, or else punish them with death. And this is the fact of the matter, because this is what happened. You know, they forced people to come and pray on Sunday and to conform to Christian ideals, and that's not the way that we function in the world. You know, I would often say to folks that are firm believers in the Christian faith that we were still in the Garden of Eden. You know, we We didn't have jails. We had no word for... it didn't exist in our language or in our world. You know, these are things that... And we didn't have stealing because everybody shared generously with one another. The Christians, when they landed here, they even talked about our behavior and said that we were more Christ-like than many of the Christians they knew, but yet they still sought to convert us to the standing of the church. And they did that with bloodshed and war and a lot of atrocities, and that's the facts. Hmm. And that's completely omitted from the story and the telling of Thanksgiving. And our reality of today is completely omitted by the idea that we're extinct, and our issues that we're concerning are moving forward in today's world are overshadowed by this idea of having to even lay claim to our continued existence. So it's a cyclical problem, and it does turn all of us into activists and advocates and diplomats and representatives of our people, because, you know, so often, you know, people are just even surprised that we still exist.
You know, Hartman, I get invited to many parts of this continent and beyond, and I approach with a sort of delicate foot on the ground, as I consider myself, you know, an invited guest. And so I guess just through lived experience, my way is to, like, okay, who are the people here? And let me show some respect, get to know, handshake, little gift. And in certain regions, there's a much more formal, like I'd say the West Coast, Northwest Coast, there's a very formal kind of protocol involved. And I've seen how that's transformed different campuses or different events where they're like, oh, we didn't really think about that. You know, they'd think, oh, we're bringing a Native dance company, that's enough. Like, yeah, we're actually just guests here. And imagine if that mindset had been what happened when people landed on Wampanoag land, you know, to ask permissions, to give gifts. And so there's this new thing that I guess I'm hoping it's going to save me like 10 hours of free cultural consultation every time I get a gig, which is basically this honored Native lands document. And it's been generated with consultation of a lot of respected Native people and organizations. And it's sort of a suggestion and to people, you know, people, organizations, events, to have an acknowledgement that they are on Native lands. And it's funny, when I first had mentioned it to different places, it sounded super exotic to them, like, oh, you know, she's asking for the world. Like, it happens a lot in Canada, Australia, New Zealand. It's kind of standard. Mm-hmm. And so now there's actually quite a number of San Francisco organizations who are considering it and stepping up, because it and then others that are like, oh, but if we acknowledge, then we have to sort of recognize that, you know, we're actually, our school's on treaty land that's, you know, it's not really, you know, it's like, oh, yeah, then, you know, there are some reconsiderations. Mm-hmm. Our board won't let us do this because that means we have to be in real negotiations. I'm like, this is the reality, people. So let's, like, wake up and figure how we can move into more... mutual, reciprocal relations. Like, I just met this lovely young woman, and I was asking everybody in the room, I think this was at, I was in Vermont the other, last week, and we were asking everyone in the room to sort of, you know, introduce themselves from a cultural perspective, and she was sort of her head was hanging, and she said she actually was a Mayflower descendant, including coming from William Bradford, the governor, but the organization she was with was about service. And she was heading to the West Coast, to the Quillit Nation, in service, which I think initially is going to mean listening. Mm. And I thought, you know, she's someone who's not erasing, like, oh, I had nothing to do with it. She's saying, you know what, I'm taking responsibility. I'm moving in a good way, not just pretending things didn't happen or she's not connected to it. And I had a lot of respect for that young woman.
Mm. Rulon Tongan is artistic director and choreographer of Dancing Earth, an intertribal indigenous contemporary dance group. Kenny Ramos is a performing artist with Dancing Earth. And on Friday, December 1st, they will be performing 500 Years of Resistance, 7 o'clock at the Brava Theater in San Francisco. We're also joined today by Hartman Dietz, member of the Wampanoag tribe. He's joining us from Mashpee, Massachusetts. Today, we are talking about what it really means to give thanks while honoring and acknowledging the true history of Thanksgiving. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow and Friday, we will have specials for you as we take a break, and then we'll be back on Monday. Your Call's One Planet series. We'll be speaking with young environmental activists who just returned from the climate conference in Germany. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are having a conversation with Native Americans about what it means to give thanks while honoring and acknowledging the true history of Thanksgiving. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests, if you have any comments about or questions about the history of Thanksgiving, if you have any children, what do they learn about Thanksgiving in school? And if you're Indigenous, how do you deal with this day? How do you let people know about the history of Thanksgiving while also practicing gratitude? 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Rulong Tongan, Artistic Director and Choreographer of Dancing Earth, an Indigenous contemporary dance group. Kenny Ramos is a performing artist with Dancing Earth on Friday, December 1st at 7 o'clock at the Brava Theater in San Francisco. They will be performing 500 Years of Resistance, a performance honoring Native land treaties and water rights. We're also joined today by Hartman Dietz, member of the Wampanoag tribe. He's joining us from Mashpee, Massachusetts. Hartman, you travel around the country talking about these issues. What really strikes you about the response you get? And how do you answer people's questions when they say, how can we honor Thanksgiving while also giving thanks?
Well, I think Thanksgivings are very important. You know, for my folks, we had 13 Thanksgivings a year. So starting right there with the understanding of what it is to truly give thanks and be thankful, it's once a year celebration of greed and gluttony is not necessarily how my folks would have celebrated Thanksgiving. And greed is such a problem, you know, fundamental problem with American society. We celebrate it as a value, and yet it's led to so many issues in our social structure, in our environment, in our economic systems. You know, greed is a really foundational problem. So, you know, to talk to people about how we think of the world and how we receive the world is important. And to really give a real acknowledgement for the fact that when we consume food, we are taking life. And this is the same whether we're taking the life of a turkey or whether we're taking the life of the pumpkin for the pumpkin pie. They all live and breathe and bear children in the next generation. They all die. And when we think of these lives as equal value to human life, which, you know, is so, you know, such a foreign concept for Western thinking, you know, you have to acknowledge and be thankful and be grateful and appreciative of those lives that were given for us to continue, and to understand as well that there's a time for us to have to sacrifice and to give of ourselves for the next to continue as well, because it's a part of it all. And, you know, and this idea that everything is for the taking, for me, you know, whether it's the resources of food or whether it's the dollar you're trying to earn, or, you know, whether it's just not wanting to give of yourself because it will somehow cost you. It's, you know, it's way of thinking. And so, you know, to address these ideas and this systematic underlying foundational problem, I think is really important for not only for, you know, the recognition of Native people and the history of being able to get over some of those problems of racial tension. And, you know, you have to work to solve the injustices of history before you can move forward. And yet there's never any attempt to acknowledge the problems that exist. They just want to, you know, there's this idea that people should just be happy now, you know, without acknowledging the past of genocide and land theft and slavery and police killings and these other things that are continuing social problems. And you know, until we acknowledge those things, until we can acknowledge what we're taking and what it takes for us to continue in this life and what should be expected us to sacrifice and give up, because, you know, that's an important part of the cycle as well. And sometimes that giving up is means giving up some of the systems of power, some of the power positions that you've been afforded for your race or for your religion or for your sexual identity or for your, you know, gender or, you know, these other things that people are oppressed for. So, it's really dealing with the core foundational values of this nation, and it's a sickness that needs to be dealt with. And if we don't deal with it, you know, not only will we suffer here in the United States, but, you know, we'll see a continuing of suffering around the world as the environment degrades because we're taking too much and using too much and putting out too much waste.
You know, Hartman, that was exactly, you've come to the core of what we've been doing, like about 11 years of work, first on water protection, then on seeds, native foods, renewable energy, and they all come down to these idea of being connected to every living being, to the life force. And I found with the dancers in the room, we were able to find connection very easily, not just with each other, even though we're coming from very, very diverse backgrounds, different tribal perspectives, etc., but connecting with branch. Like, we're just as likely to be dancing out a non-human element, a branch, a rock. And then we even found that we were able to connect with a rubber ball and with safety pins and understand that they're all life force that's not to be wasted, not this, like, okay, I'm done with it, throw it out. But the scene yesterday we were really struggling with was the scene about greed, which has to happen. It's been in every piece, mm-hmm. whether it's the GMOs in the seed piece or pollution of water from hydrofracking several years back, far before Standing Rock, but that's also very relevant. But in this case, it was hard for the dancers to get behind that because, and I said, listen, we're trying to be conduits here so we can create this, you know, on stage, this understanding of the difference of these worldviews and how we can, you know, like, you know, I'm thinking more like I want to colonize them with that, our worldview, but I'm trying to, you know, not make a judgment before the piece is created. Like, what is the struggle of moving towards better understanding? And I shouldn't use the word colonize. It's a different power structure, of course. It's re-indigenizing rather than, you know, you can't colonize from a place of, you know, less power. But in the name of that, we all, of moving over power and bringing resources and restoration, of course, I need to, I should have done this at the very beginning, but I wanted to just acknowledge that we are here on the West Coast on Ramaytush Ohlone land. And I'm very, when I'm talking to people about what comes tomorrow, I note that on the two coasts, there's this strongholds at Plymouth Rock tomorrow at sunrise and at Alcatraz tomorrow at sunrise, holding this, like, this truth. Mm. I mean, the boats to Alcatraz are completely sold out. There's over 450 people that are ready to stand in solidarity with intertribal peoples on that rock. And I'm sure Plymouth Rock will be filled, too. And
the boats to Alcatraz are totally sold out?
Yes, I think if you are able to line up at 3 a.m., you might be able to get some extra tickets. And there's people that are ready to do that.
We have a link to that at yourcallradio.org. It's the Indigenous Peoples Sunrise Gathering.
Yeah, and so there's, you know, like, we're on stage, we will be, the opening is a welcoming by cultural artists who represent the neighboring host tribes here, Pomo and Ohlone. And we don't just say, you know, so we do more than land acknowledge. We don't just acknowledge that we're on the land. We bring those people there to represent themselves. And then over the years, many years, we've built a relationship. So now they're not just doing an opening song and walking off. I'm having them stay on stage the entire time and continue as part of the performance because, from my mind, they've always been here. They will always be here. So they need to be on stage from the beginning to end. And, in fact, they come off the stage into the audience at the very end to just bring that energy right to the people to understand that, you know, they're alive, they're breathing, we're all part of the same city here, kind of re-indigenizing the San Francisco streets.
That is Rulon Tongan, Artistic Director and Choreographer of Dancing Earth, an Indigenous Contemporary Dance Group. Kenny Ramos is a performing artist with Dancing Earth. 500 Years of Resistance will be performed Friday, December 1st at 7 o'clock at the Brava Theater in San Francisco. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. We're also joined today by Hartman Dietz, member of the Wampanoag Tribe, joining us from Mashpee, Massachusetts. And if you'd like to join us today, we are talking about what it it means to give thanks while honoring and acknowledging the true history of Thanksgiving. What does this day mean to you? What does it mean for you to give thanks? We'd love to hear from you. Also, if you have any questions for our guests about the history of Thanksgiving, the number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. What about you, Kenny? What does it mean for you to give thanks while acknowledging the history?
What does it mean for us to give thanks? I mean, we're thankful. My family, we're thankful every day because we survived. We've survived the mission system and Spanish colonization of California. We survived the Mexican Rancho and the Mexican government, which relied on California Indian labor and gave land out to if indigenous people didn't have rights under the Mexican government. So we didn't have rights to our own land, and we were forced to work our own land for other people. And we survived California Indian slavery and the Gold Rush and all these things. California is an atrocious state. When you really look at the history, there was a legalized California Indian slave trade mm-hmm. that was paid for by the government. And they were paying for our scalps. You can find old newspapers of the California government paying bounty for us. And so it's, you know, for us to still be here and to be alive, we're thankful. We're thankful for that. And I'm thankful every day. I really enjoy listening to everyone sharing and listening to Hearts and talk about, the experiences that tribes there had with contact in the 1400s and, well, even after with the 1600s. You know, it's really interesting, and we have different stories, but at the end, we have these really common threads of just being oppressed in our own homelands and killed. And I think we can all agree that we're just so grateful to be still here today and to be able to have these conversations and hopefully share this knowledge with people that aren't thinking about this every day. And for us to be able to think about our kids and trying to create space for more Native artists or trying to get our languages revitalized, that, you know, that's really powerful and really important discussions to be had. And I'm thankful for all of that.
We had a conversation with Andres Resendez about his book, The Other Slavery, The Uncovered Story of Indian Enslavement in America. I think it was earlier this year, and you can find that at yourcallradio.org. Let's go to a caller. Let's hear from Nanette in Alameda. Hi, Nanette. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Thank you for having me on your show. I'm very honored. I wanted to say, to mitakuye, shante washteya, nape eusapele, Nanette. Na Dakota, na Chalagi, na Alameda, e Matahan. And I just said, hello, my relatives. From my heart, I extend my hand and say to you, welcome. I am Dakota Cherokee, and I live in Alameda. So, and I am also a cousin of Hartman Dietz, and I'm very happy to hear that you had him on your wonderful program. He holds quite a lot of knowledge for such a young man. And I just want to say that I'm so very happy you're covering all of these topics. I believe that it's so important for us to have this knowledge and dialogue about race and slavery and genocide and what it really truly means to be an American Indian in this day and age. And I'm just so thankful that what I'm thankful for is that we are able to revitalize our languages, our culture, our arts, and that we have organizations such as the International Indian Treaty Council to put on our wonderful sunrise ceremony at Alcatraz, and that we've had lots of warriors and lots of allies and lots of actions throughout the year to make Americans understand that we're still here, we're never going away, we are a part of the culture and the fabric of life, and we need to come together, all of us, to resist all of the results of colonization and division and bring us all together to really move forward and create the world we would like to see.
Nanette, can I ask you, what does it mean for you to move forward? What changes would you like to see? I mean, we do a lot of shows about these issues, not just during Native Heritage Month. We do it all year. And there's so much new research coming out, new books coming out about California genocide, about slavery. There's just so many things that are happening right now. What do you think about this? Do you feel like it's an awakening? And what are your thoughts about that?
I feel like it is, and I'm very happy to see real history being written. I believe I'm an educator and a journalist and an artist, and I would like to see history taught in a completely different way. Mm-hmm. As far as I'm concerned, we need to teach history from the viewpoint of American Indians. That is the history of the United States, because we are a colonial experiment. Something that apparently worked, according to those who write history. But I believe right now what I would like to see is history rewritten in the way that Roxanne Dunbar Ortiz wrote in her new book. This new book about the other slavery is so important. I would like to see the true history of the United States be taught in our schools. You know, as far as I'm concerned, it hasn't been in a long time. And I'd like to see us come together and really work on decolonizing all of our minds and getting back to indigenous values. At one time, all of us were indigenous, and we all had very similar world views. They weren't the same. I'm not saying that. They're very deeply diverse. However, there are some similarities in terms of not seeing the earth as something we can just continually take from, or people. So those are kind of the things I'd like to see us move forward with. I'd like to see our languages taught in schools, right alongside Spanish, French, German, Italian, Japanese, Chinese. All of those are always given much more validity than the land that we actually live on. Hmm. And I think that's extremely important. Many, many people in America are far too willing to look to other cultures, other languages, other ways of healing, for knowledge, for wisdom, rather than what's right here from this land on which they stand. And I think that's very important. That's what I would like to see all of us move forward with and toward. You know, that's what I want to see.
Well, thank you so much for calling in, Nanette.
And thank you for the programs throughout the year.
It's been a long year. Thank you so much.
Uh-huh.
Hartman, what would you add to that, that your cousin just called in? What would you add just in terms of moving forward?
It's really important to decolonize our thinking. And, you know, and this can start fundamentally with learning how to speak the language of the land. They say that when languages die, oftentimes the ecosystems die with them, because there's such an intimate knowledge of their surroundings, of the land and the ground that they come from, that there's a better way of speaking about their local environment in the languages that come from that land. And that really shouldn't be a big surprise, but somehow it is, you know, in this world of monolingual monoculture and, you know, monocropping, it's really important. And, you know, like you say, just we need to be included in the dialogue. We need to be included in the history. You know, how many other places in the world, you know, if you learn about English history in England, it doesn't start someplace else. It doesn't start in Spain. If you learn about Chinese history in China, is not going to start in Ethiopia. But for some reason, when we learn about American history, it starts in Italy or Spain or someplace in Europe. That's where the first chapters of the book always are. Mm. And the fact of the matter is that we have thousands upon thousands of years of history from this part of the world. The story of the Americas starts here. And that means this history of indigenous people, and we need to be able to teach that in an honest way if we want to you know, continue to acknowledge the reality of our world here today.
You know, I totally am so strengthened by the words of Nanette and Hartman as they talk about this, you know, the resources that we have to decolonize our education through language reclamation and access to, you know, more accurate, more full histories. And I also, in the name of decolonization, want to look towards music and dance, which actually have always been the functional rituals for transformations for all of our peoples. They're a way of marking time, whether it's birth, death, transitions into marriage, courtship. And as contemporary Native intertribal Indigenous peoples, we have to take responsibilities to make the new rituals that speak to the relevant issues of our time. So whether that means, you know, through hip-hop, through our theater practice, like, you know, one of our artists that's going to be joining us, his name is Artson, and he just won a NAMI Award for a video called Never Give Up, which is at the core of what Nanette, Hartman, Kenny are all saying, you know, about gratitude for resilience. I do also acknowledge dance as this very, very special way of embodying the future. We're not talking about the future, how we wish it was or would be. We have the ability to put it into our bodies and experience it. And that is that's such a vital power. And that's one of the reasons why it was put down. And actually, you know, like at Wounded Knee, it was a massacre of ghost dancers. It was men, women, children, elders, but they were ghost dancing. And some people would be like, God, they were just dancing. You know, why did they kill them? It's because dance is such a force for revolution. So there is no revolution without music. There is no revolution without dance. And that's what we're hoping to bring in a way that inspires hope. Yes, there's anger in the truth-telling, but what our elders have said is what's important for our peoples is to bring about hope so we can have the energy to keep going.
Mm. We have time for... go ahead, Harmon.
I might just jump in and just say that, you know, dance and music are super important means of passing information off to the next generation. These are means of teaching.
Yeah.
These are Indigenous ways of transferring knowledge. Mm-hmm. And so this is also, right along with language, really important to decolonizing the way that we learn from the world. Mm-hmm. And to be able to acknowledge non-human teachers, such as mountains, such as birds, such as glaciers, that these can be teachers that are every bit as much valid as a professor or a book or, you know, an instructional video. And so that's also something that's fundamental to decolonization. And, you know, jumping back to the idea of food, you know, food decolonization is such a huge thing for Native people right now. And it's really sad that the New York Times article missed. I take too much more time, but I'll let you
know. No, so sad. I'm still thinking about that one. We have time for one more caller. Let's go to Molly in San Francisco. Hi, Molly.
Hello, I'm a high school teacher on the peninsula, and I've been thinking a lot about how do you break up the narrative of the myth of America with students. And one thing that occurred to me is that we're in California, right? And Mexican Independence and Central American Independence Day came along, and I started talking to my students in terms of if we were to actually teach history starting from a local spot and moving up to the quote-unquote formation of the nation. In California, we had nothing to do in California with England in 1776 or 1789. You know, this was quote-unquote Spain and then Mexico and first native lands, then Spain, then Mexico. And so what we did is we made a deliberate effort to, just as like one way of peeling back the onion on this, because their faces just went like, what? What are you talking about? So we were peeling back the onion and said, well, what we really have to do is, here in California, we should be also celebrating independence from Spain if this was Mexico. And then you can keep going back, but I'm thoroughly impressed with, and it's not surprising, but how entrenched all the myths are and the work that it takes to break those apart. And I think it starts with local history and then moving out.
Yeah. Well, thank you for that. We've done shows. Benjamin Madley has an amazing book, American Genocide, the United States and the California Indian Catastrophe, 1846 to 1873. Lots of good stuff out there, but we just need to elevate that information. Final thoughts, Kenny? You just shook your head. You're familiar with that one?
Well, yeah, that's one of my professors from, from UCLA, Ben Medley. He's great, and his book is great. And he came to our tribe just this year. We had a book club on my reservation, and we read his book. And it's actually really fascinating to talk about even sometimes how we, our people, don't buy into some of the myths.
Yes, I was talking about this with my dad, because he's Pomo and Paiute, and said, we always celebrated Thanksgiving and really didn't talk about this stuff.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
For a lot of reasons.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We do now, but...
Yeah, for sure.
Just quickly, for people who maybe want to bring this up during lunch or dinner tomorrow, what would you say?
Oh, gosh, what would I say? I'm so, like, funny. Or I don't think I'm funny. Anyone that says I'm funny isn't funny. But, like, I would just be... I'm so straight up. I'm like, let's talk about how many Indians died, like, for this. Or let's talk about, you know, let's talk about just the truth. I don't know. I'm pretty candid. I would just... ready to just kind of pop up in the can like that.
Yeah. Kenny Ramos is a performing artist with Dancing Earth, and Rulon Tongan is artistic director with Dancing Earth, an indigenous contemporary dance group. They will be performing 500 Years of Resistance Friday, December 1st at 7 o'clock at the Brava Theater in San Francisco. And Hartman Dietz is a member of the Wampanoag tribe joining us from Mashpee, Massachusetts. Kenny, Rulon, and Hartman, thank you all for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Yehan. It's been...
Thank you. And you can find...
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Coming up tomorrow and Friday, we will have specials. We're taking some time off. We'll be back on Monday for Your Call's One Planet series, and we'll be speaking with young environmentalists who just got back from Germany. Your Call is produced here at KALW. You can sign up for our podcast at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Laura Flynn for producing today's show. Thanks to Matt Martin for line producing. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. I'm Rose Aguilar. Thank you for joining us. It's Your Call.